Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We are your hosts today. I'm Jackie Norman, together with Dennis Hart.
Jackie, it's a pleasure being with you today on your last day as a host of this broadcast. I'm going to be shedding some tears a bit later, I think. How about you?
I might, too, when I get home.
When you get home. Okay. Well, before that happens, let's start our broadcast by looking back at news from last Saturday's Ames Tribune, part of our weekly news summary from the pages of that newspaper. Last Saturday's paper reported that part of the project to renovate restrooms inside the Parks Library at Iowa State University has wrapped up just in time for students like you, Jackie, who are returning to campus for the fall semester. The project involved reconfiguring 14 existing restrooms throughout all five levels of the northwest part of the library so that they would meet the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act and handle the university's increased enrollment. The Parks Library is one of the most used buildings on campus, with more than 12,000 students, faculty, and staff visiting each day during the semester. Amazing. Saturday's trip also had word about an Iowa State University graduate and Marshalltown native who has returned to her home state to take over as the Director of Curriculum, Instruction, and Assessment with the Ames School District. Amy Lane, who most recently worked in Colorado, is taking over duties formerly performed by Associate Ames Superintendent Mandy Ross, who departed recently to become superintendent in Webster City. There was more in Saturday's trip, including word that Cornbread Barbecue plans to open a restaurant on Main Street in Ames this fall. The business will take over the former Depot Deli and adjacent nail salon at 526 Main Street. Cornbread will continue to operate a food truck during the summer. And there was word that an Iowa State University graduate is starting a laundry service that would pick up dirty clothes, clean and fold them, and return them to customers within 24 hours. You can read all about Rebecca Mallett's new business in Saturday's Tribune. Sunday's Trib reported that a jury trial has been set for a lawsuit filed against the Ames School District. That suit alleges that two residential properties were damaged by flooding as a result of work done near the district's 24th Street complex. Two families say their home suffered thousands of dollars in damage when stormwater basins overflowed, sending water into neighboring properties. A jury trial will hear evidence in that case starting next August. Sunday's Trib also had word that a group of Iowa State University students and local renters have formed a tenants union to combat what it says is illegal abuse of renters by their landlords. The group is called the Ames Tenants Union, and its goal is to achieve what it calls housing justice for local tenants and for the homeless, to educate tenants about their legal rights, and to give tenants access to legal help if they cannot afford it themselves. Eventually, the union would like to buy or develop properties and run them as cooperatives, where the tenants would elect a board and run their building democratically. And Sunday's Trib also reported the final results of the recent Rummage Rampage community sales event here in Ames. About 51 tons, that's 102,000 pounds, of furniture and housewares were diverted from landfills, and more than $18,000 raised for local nonprofits. The Trib is not published on Mondays, and Tuesday's edition reported that recent mosquito trappings had revealed there is a continued risk of West Nile virus here in Ames. Mosquitoes found in a trap at Emma McCarthy Lee Park were the ones tested. Authorities said the results show residents need to take precautions, such as wearing clothing that covers much of our skin and using mosquito repellent. West Nile can, in some cases, cause serious illness. Tuesday's Trib also had word that the Ames School Board received an update on the progress of the high school construction project Monday night. The architectural team, OPN, presented new designs and ideas. The company's primary concerns included parking and using the views that are available at the school site. As the evening progressed, the idea of student and teacher safety became a more pressing issue for school board members. Also Tuesday, the Tribune reported on the public presentation made Monday by one of the two candidates for the position of Ames Fire Chief. Rich Higgins, who is now the interim chief, made his case to about 30 people. He is competing against former Davenport Fire Chief Lynn Washburn Livingston, who made her public presentation 2 weeks ago. Higgins said his leadership experience within the department makes him the better candidate. He started his career with the City of Ames as a public works employee 18 years ago. He began work with the fire department back in 2002 and has moved up the ranks since then, becoming deputy fire chief in 2012. Also Tuesday, word the two longtime Democratic Party volunteers were honored Sunday in Ames. Melinda and Kurt Bauer were recognized by party members for their decades-long volunteering efforts. One more note from Tuesday's Tribune, a reminder about the 24th annual Senior Variety Show that will take place tonight, Friday, and tomorrow at the Ames City Auditorium. This year's offering is called Simply Stellar, And as always, it includes numerous skits and music. Tonight's show starts at 7:30. Tomorrow afternoon's begins at 2. Wednesday's Trib reported that the Ames City Council held off on passing new hardship exemptions to the city's rental cap ordinance during its meeting Tuesday night. This after the council failed to override Mayor John Hala's veto of exemptions that had earlier been passed. The council voted to direct city staff to make 3 changes to a new hardship exemptions plan. It's yet another complex twist in the ongoing effort by the council to establish rental limits in neighborhoods near Iowa State. At Tuesday's Story County Board of Supervisors meeting, the supervisors approved buying 225 acres of land for conservation purposes. The board purchased Carroll Prairie, 50 acres of undeveloped prairie land north of Nevada, and also bought the Jordan Family Wildlife Area, which is a 175-acre nature preserve south of Ames. The cost of the 50-acre parcel, $80,000. The price of the 175-acre site is $550,000, but private fundraising efforts and state and federal grants have taken care of virtually the entire cost. Wednesday's Trib also reported that work has started on repainting Boone's largest water tower. It's being done by hand, and it will take 3 months to finish. The $458,000 project will give a fresh coat of white and red paint to the 150-foot-tall tower at 1st and South Clinton Streets. That tower holds 750,000 gallons of water. Boone repaints its towers every 10 or 15 years or so, and the other 2 towers in town, they've already been repainted. Thursday's Trib had word that the National Weather Service reports that those 3 tornadoes that touched down in Story County back on July 19th have now been rated as EF-0s. That's the weakest on the scale used to measure a tornado's intensity. Tornadoes that are EF-0s produce wind speeds of 65 to 85 miles an hour. The 3 that hit Story County landed near Story City, Roland, and Collins. All of them stayed in rural agricultural areas. No building damage was reported. That same day, of course, much stronger tornadoes hit Bondurant, Pella, and Marshalltown, causing major damage in each location. Thursday's Trib also reported that Iowa State University is lending YSS, one of its spare buildings, in campus town for the next few months, while the nonprofit organization determines the future of its building at 712 Burnett Avenue in Ames. You may remember that house sustained more than $350,000 damage in a fire last June. Investigators still do not know what caused it. The house was used as a residential treatment facility for teenage girls with alcohol and substance abuse issues. All 8 residents and 2 staff members who were there when the fire broke out escaped injury. They were temporarily housed in a hotel, but now have been moved into the Sigma Alpha Epsilon home on Lynn Avenue in Campus Town. That fraternity house has been vacant for the past 3 years because the fraternity has been on suspension. Meanwhile, YSS says it has not made a decision about what to do with the house on Burnett. Also in Thursday's Trib, word that the Ames City Council has approved offering about $8 million in bonds for the planned Grand Avenue extension and other infrastructure projects. Grand Avenue now ends at Squaw Creek Drive just south of the Lincoln Center Hy-Vee. Plans are to extend Grand through the Coldwater Golf Links and connect it to South 16th Street. South 5th Street would be extended west to meet the Grand Avenue extension. One more note from yesterday's paper, word about the upcoming 8th annual Chalk the Walks event going to take place next Tuesday the 21st, when all of us are encouraged to spread positive messages and images in chalk at several different locations. Among those places in Ames, the Public Library, City Hall, and several parks, including Brookside, Duff, Northridge Heights, Daly, and Country Gables. Don't have to bring your own chalk. It's going to be provided. Chalk the Walk takes place in all 50 states, as well as in several countries, including Australia, Brazil, Canada, England, India, Japan, Mexico, even more. Today's Trib reports that the Ames City Council has given the green light to the Northcrest community to almost triple the size of its current capacity for senior living residents. Northcrest plans to add 231 new units to its 5-acre lot on 24th Street in Ames. All those units will have 2 bedrooms, so the expansion can house at least 462 new residents when it's completed sometime next year. Also in today's Trib, word that animal shelters in both Boone and Ames are holding a special adoption event this weekend. They're going to offer reduced adoption rates or even entirely free adoptions, free, to encourage potential pet owners to take animals home. It's part of a nationwide pet adoption drive called Clear the Shelters. And one more note from today's paper. Your eyes were not deceiving you last night, Jackie, if you were walking around downtown Ames and noticed people dressed as iconic literary characters. They were taking part in the Ames Library's 2nd annual Pub Fiction Crawl, a fundraiser that lets people dress in costumes based on their favorite literary characters and enjoy adult beverages at several locations. So, Jackie, if I were going down there last night, I probably would have dressed as a combination of Hercule Poirot, the great detective, and Winnie the Pooh, which would have been kind of strange. How about you? How would you have been dressed last night?
Probably as one of my favorite comic book characters, either Red Hood or Harley Quinn.
Wow, that would have been quite a sight last night. Both of us walking down there looking strange. Okay, that's your summary of the week's news. It's over from the page of the Ames Tribune. I'll be back on Monday with a look at what makes news around Iowa this past week. Well, Jackie, if you go to the farmer's market in Ames this year, you're going to find a new and unusual business. Shelby Smith is a cricket farmer. That's right, I said a cricket farmer, who lives just outside Ames. Shelby sat down with our station manager, Ursula Rudenberg, recently to talk about her new business, Gym and Eat Crickets. Let's listen to that one right now.
Name of my business is Gym and Eat Crickets, and essentially what I do is I raise crickets for human consumption. I raise crickets from egg to fully grown. I kill them, I roast them, and make them into tasty treats that are not only delicious, but they are packed with nutrition.
What products are you actually selling?
So I do actually do dry roasted whole crickets, and I season those up. I have a whole bunch of different seasonings. I mix all of my own seasonings.
So that's kind of like a chip, a potato chip?
Yeah, or? Like a potato chip, or I always liken it to like a sunflower seed, because texture-wise, that's kind of what it's like. It's just very crunchy, and flavor-wise, honestly, a plain cricket has about the flavor of a sunflower seed.
It still have its legs and antennas?
Legs,
and
eyes, everything. So, like I said, some people are really grossed out by that.
Do some people buy them?
Oh, quite a few people buy them.
Okay.
Whether it be for the novelty factor, but then again, you get people who are following a ketogenic diet, which is high fat, low carb. For those people, to get a salty, crunchy snack, like a savory snack that's not pork rinds, is difficult. So dry roasted crickets are a great option for that. And I've had quite a few keto people come and buy those because they're like, I needed something other than pork rinds that's crunchy and savory, and this is perfect. I also make protein bars. So I take the dry roasted crickets and I grind them into a fine powder that I call cricket flour. And then I mix that cricket flour into protein bars. So if you've ever had like a Lara bar or an RX bar where it's all whole foods, so it's dates and nuts and then dried fruit or whatever you use to flavor it, it's the same concept that I use with my bars.
What flavors do they end up having?
Oh my gosh, I have tons. Peanut butter chocolate chip, coconut chocolate chip, mixed berry, chocolate mint, all sorts.
So you sell whole crickets.
Yep.
Protein bars made out of crickets.
Yep.
Any other products?
Yeah, so I also do the cricket flour. So you can use it as a protein powder, so you can mix it right in a smoothie. You can mix it into hummus for a little bit of extra protein, a little extra nutrition. It's whatever you want to do with it. The beauty of it as well as a protein powder, if you go buy whey protein or you go buy some vegan protein from the store, chances are like it's incredibly processed. The FDA doesn't really require that the supplement companies disclose exactly what's in it. So you don't really know what's in your protein powder. If you're using this cricket flour as your protein powder, I can tell you exactly what's in it. It's 100% crickets.
Can it actually be used as flour, or this is more of a protein powder?
No, it can actually be used as flour. You can bake with it.
Can you make bread with it?
You can bake bread with it. There's a certain ratio of 2/3, 1/3 of regular flour to cricket flour, and you can put that in any recipe that calls for flour, whether it be gluten-free or regular flour. I've just started to figure out sourdough bread. So I made my own starter from scratch and all of that. And it's taken me forever to actually figure out the way to get it to rise properly and not, it's been a nightmare. but ideally I want to do a cricket sourdough bread.
I noticed your business's t-shirt.
Yes.
It says Gym and Eat Cricket.
Yeah.
So I see you're also playing on the health food.
Yeah.
Humorously with the name of the company.
Yes.
Has Disney contacted you yet?
They have not.
For royalties on
yes,
the name?
Yes, they have not.
Actually, when I was in the farmer's market, I heard somebody ask you if you had a gym.
Yes. Yeah, I get that. Yes, yeah. I get that a lot. You know, I get a lot of people are like, do you have a gym? I'm like, not yet.
Well, maybe you should.
You know, and that is, ideally, I would love that. Because I love the whole package.
You're essentially a cricket farmer.
I am a cricket farmer. You know, if you asked me a year ago today if I was going to be a cricket farmer in 365 days, I would have told you were crazy. But here I am.
Okay, so tell us how it happened.
Yeah, so, well, long story short, well, actually, I suppose I'll just go into the long story. About a year ago, I quit my job as an investment banker. I was over in Dublin, Ireland, trading equity derivatives, so National Bank of Canada. I'd done that for about 3.5 years. I had originally gone over to Ireland with a program called Sport Changes Life. It's a bit of a community outreach program that uses sport as a medium to further certain values within kids.
So you were in Ireland playing basketball?
Yeah. So I was actually in Dublin. We were called Victory Scholars. Myself and another girl from Massachusetts, we were the first group that were in Dublin. And so we got our masters, played professionally over there, and then coached in underprivileged areas. So it was the first year that we had had people in the south of Ireland, in Ireland, as many people think of it. And the reason that we played basketball is because the Catholics and the Protestants have been at each other for hundreds of years. And in Belfast, to the point where, you know, there's still the peace wall and everything that separates the Catholics and the Protestants. But basketball is a non-denominational sport. It's not one that's associated with a particular religion. In Ireland, rugby and soccer tend to be Protestant sports, whereas the Gaelic sports like hurling and Gaelic football are obviously Catholic sports. So basketball is just a complete anomaly because nobody really played it. It was very unifying in that way. If you were playing basketball, you were just a basketball player. And so that was what I did for the first year. I got my master's in finance at Trinity College in Dublin. And then really enjoyed playing with the team that I was playing with. So I decided to stick around and stay for another year and went searching for a job. Wound up on a trading desk at the National Bank of Canada's Dublin location and stuck around there for another 3.5 years.
So now you're in Dublin and you're working in a bank.
Yep.
And you're also still doing the basketball?
For the first year that I was working with the bank, I played basketball. In that first year, I was kind of in an internship role, so time demands weren't quite as bad. And then I got moved to trading about a year into it. And so at that point, the hours I was going to pull and the client obligations and all that sort of thing, it wasn't going to be possible to keep playing basketball. So I decided to hang up the basketball shoes and focus on work. So to fill that void, I started to get into bodybuilding competition, but then I really fell in love with obstacle course racing. Ended up qualifying for world championships of that in 2016 out in Lake Tahoe. And then I also did my first 24-hour World's Toughest Mudder. So it's a 24-hour obstacle race that was out in Las Vegas.
What is an obstacle race? What does it actually look like?
It's mud pits, it's walls. In certain cases in Tough Mudder, you go through these little electrocution things, which why anyone would pay to do that, I'm not sure.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I loved it. So I did end up doing it again this past November. It was pretty
cool. So we've established that you like challenges, that you're competitive.
Yes.
And you are athletic.
Yes.
And meanwhile, you were still working in a bank. What were the next steps towards becoming a cricket farmer?
Yes. I mean, the first one obviously was me handing in my resignation as a banker. About August of last year, it really came to a head that I was not entirely happy in the high finance world. Even 3 degrees later, double majoring in my undergrad and then getting my master's in finance.
Working in finances didn't satisfy you?
Yeah, it didn't.
What did you miss?
I didn't feel like I was actually building anything or helping anyone, if that makes any sense. Granted, yes, I was making these large sums of money for this big bank. And, you know, some people would argue that money makes the world go round and allows for all of these programs that are good for people. And I agree with that to a certain extent. But there's lots of ways to make money and still do good while doing well. So I really craved that. My dad's farmed for over 30 years just outside of Ames here. My brother's actually a fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force. So, you know, ideally he'd be the one to come back and take over and, you know, run that whole operation. For about the last year and a half before I quit my job, my parents were kind of like, well, you know, you could come back and, you know, dad could teach you to farm. And I was like, yeah, okay. I don't know if I could do that. Because growing up, you know, I wasn't really involved in the chores and stuff. I was always playing basketball or gymnastics or soccer, something.
And your parents grew
corn and soybeans for the last 30-something years. So when I quit my job August of last year, I got a flight back here for October 1st and jumped right in headfirst to harvest. So I actually traveled for about 26 hours to get back between layovers and everything. And when I got back, it was dark out and my dad goes, well, let's go move corn. And so there I was. And so right when I started, move corn that day, learned how to run the grain cart the next 2 days, spilled corn everywhere, but it's one of those things he forgives me.
So you're also a hard worker.
Yeah, something like that. Glutton for punishment, maybe. I'm not sure. But yeah, so went through harvest all fall, and then...
You brought up the idea of cricket farming?
January 1st. New Year's Day.
You came to them and said, I'm thinking about being a cricket farmer.
Yeah, so I actually, there was...
Okay, now wait a minute. Where did you get the idea to do this?
I listened to a lot of podcasts, some fitness podcasts. Entomophagy, which is the eating of bugs, had come up rather often, like surprisingly. People eating crickets or down in Mexico eating chapulines, which are roasted grasshoppers. And I started looking into it, and I found an article about the Iowa cricket farmer, which was the first woman to become a cricket farmer in Iowa. She's out in Keystone, Iowa. And I sent it to both my parents. Well, what about crickets? You know, could I do this? And they both kind of looked at me like, well, that'd be kind of interesting, I guess. I don't know. And my dad said, you know, if you want to figure out a niche rather than being at the mercy of the markets that I have been for the past, you know, 30 plus years, go for it, and we will try to support you as much as we can. And so 10 days later, I had ordered my first 10,000 crickets.
So what made you think that it was a viable business in this area?
I actually do a finished product. So I take it from the cricket all the way through to the protein bar or the roasted cricket. So
it's the processing that makes it
exactly.
makes it profitable.
Right, which is generally the case in any kind of farming, you know.
Yeah.
Farmers are at the low man at the totem pole, if you will. You do the majority of the work, but you're not going to get the majority of the profit. So ideally, I want a vertical integration of everything. Because otherwise, then it just becomes the same game as what my dad is in corn and soybeans.
Where did you order the crickets from?
I actually ordered the crickets from a farm down in Georgia. They have Georgia and Louisiana locations, and so they are pretty much the corner on the live market. So anyone who has like a snake or a lizard or anything that, you know, needs to be fed crickets, you generally will buy them from there. Zoos, all of them would typically buy them from this farm.
How many crickets came?
10,000.
10,000, and you got a box full of crickets jumping around?
Yeah, so I actually got two boxes of crickets.
Was the box silent, or was the box making noise?
The box was silent. So these were only about 2 week old crickets.
Mm-hmm.
So crickets don't start to chirp until they are mature enough to breed.
These were baby crickets.
These were baby crickets.
So when you open up the box, they were all jumping around in there?
Well, the box was all very taped shut and everything sealed tightly. As soon as you cut open the tape, you start to have the crickets start to crawl out. So they, I ended up losing quite a few, I would say, just because and it was my first foray into crickets, so I had no idea what I was facing. I just remember when my dad walked in the room after, he's like, there's kind of crickets everywhere. I was like, yeah, I didn't mean for that to happen. It just kind of did. Here.
So you're a brand new cricket farmer.
Oh, I am a brand new cricket farmer.
So I guess there's a lot of chirping.
Yeah.
Okay. Has it been difficult or easy?
It's been simple conceptually. Easy is a different story.
Simple, but not easy.
But not easy. Yeah.
What's hard?
Part of the problem is there's very little guidance on what to do.
So it's trial and error.
Oh, 100% is trial and
error. So what's one of your biggest mistakes?
Oh, my goodness. I would say probably my biggest mistake was it would have been either my second or third round of actually hatching babies. So I had bought these tubs, big plastic storage bins that you keep them in, and you cut a hole in the top with some screen over it, and they like egg cartons because they can hide in them. And then they eat chicken feed, and then you just need a watering system. So the babies, when they hatch, they're called pinheads, and they are literally the size of a pin. They look like crickets, though. They're not larvae or anything like that, but they're teeny tiny, super easy to smash. They can drown in a droplet of water. So, like, these are, they're difficult to handle.
Delicate.
Yes, they're very delicate. So these bins had a ridge at the bottom that I didn't realize was an issue until I dumped these thousands of babies in all of these bins and then came back a couple of days later and realized they couldn't get out of the ridge, and so they trampled each other and suffocated. So I probably, at that point, I probably killed about half of my population. Yeah, it was a bummer.
Poor babies.
I went and told my parents were like, well, welcome to farming. This is how it goes.
Now, crickets have a decent life while they're alive?
I think they do. You know, they don't have to search for water. They don't have to search for food.
Mm-hmm.
They are, save the occasional spider that might get into their bin, which I have noticed the spiders have gotten a lot bigger in the room that I keep them.
You also kill the crickets?
Yes.
How old are they when you kill them?
I usually kill mine about 7 weeks. So a typical cricket will live anywhere from 8 to 10 weeks.
How does one kill so many crickets?
Freezer.
You put them in the freezer?
Put them in the freezer, yeah.
So that's a relatively painless death, right?
It's a very natural death, because if you think about it, every single year, what happens in Iowa? It freezes.
They freeze. Uh-huh.
And all the bugs die. That's just the way it is.
They just kind of go to sleep.
Yeah. So you freeze them and they go to sleep.
And then after they're dead, you roast them?
Yeah. So I dry roast them in the oven. So that takes care of any pathogens or anything that could have been harmful.
How have you helped people get over their fear of eating crickets or being grossed out by it?
You know, honestly, some people, I can't get them over it. But truthfully, I get a lot of people who make faces as they walk past my farmer's market stand, to say the least. If I can get them to come over, that at least allows them to engage. And a lot of times they'll be like, why would I want to eat these? And so I say, well, you know, they're 60% protein by dry weight. So that is double the protein of beef. They have more iron than spinach, more calcium than milk. You know, great source of vitamin B12, proper ratio of omega-6s to omega-3s. I was like, and they're pretty dang tasty. I can't tell you the amount of people that I've had come up and just grab a protein bar sample, eat it, and then go down and look at the dry roasted crickets and like, ew, these are crickets. And I'm like, well, you just ate some. In all honesty, the U.S. is relatively unique in the world in that we don't eat insects widespread. 80% of the world eats insects.
So other people in other countries are already eating crickets.
Absolutely. In Asia, on street markets, not uncommon to find scorpions and crickets and all sorts of things like that. So really, truly, America, bit of Western Europe and Canada, we're unique in the fact that we don't eat bugs.
You're at the farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen you there a number of times.
Yeah.
Are you selling on any other platform?
No. As of right now, due to licensing and that sort of thing, I'm restricted to only sell at the farmer's market or direct from home. I fall under the cottage industry laws.
Are you planning to sell online eventually?
Yes. At this point, I only have about 200,000 crickets. Eventually, when I get enough crickets, I'll get a commercial kitchen, and then I'll be able to sell online. That'll allow me to sell in retailers. So ideally, that's where I'm going. But it just takes time.
Well, this is very interesting to hear the business end of it as well.
Yeah.
you're a former investment banker. You know the life of an investment. You know how to assess investments.
Mm-hmm.
What's your assessment of this?
Well, in all honesty, the typical venture capital fund is 10 years because generally from ground zero to IPO is initial public offering when a company goes public. That's when many of these venture capital funds, that's when they receive their big paybacks that they on their initial investment.
So for 10 years, you essentially invest in it yourself.
Yes.
Until it's something ready.
Right. So then you can sell off your shares for hopefully way more than you put into it. That's the goal of every venture capital fund. But generally speaking, it's a 10-year time horizon. So I was under no impression that in 7 months I was going to suddenly be this amazing, you know, company that's just making all this money, especially me by myself. You know, it's a sole proprietorship, essentially.
You're not living from this yet. You're still farming.
I am not. Luckily, I have incredibly supportive parents that are, you know, willing to help me along. And
it's only been since January, so this is still basically a pilot project.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It's very much in its infancy.
So how many crickets do you generally have now?
Right now, I have about 200,000.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't completely outgrown the space that I'm in. Part of that was, like I said, the previous incident where I killed off half of my babies.
And are you still helping your parents with the farm?
You know, we are all soybeans this year, so labor needs are not quite as high. And honestly, this time of year, until harvest, there's not a whole lot. But obviously, once harvest starts, yeah, I'll absolutely.
Are you here to stay?
It seems I'm here to stay. I could see myself on the shelves of the Hy-Vee health food store or in Wheat's Field or in Fresh Thyme. You know, I could absolutely see that. I would love to get on, obviously, like Amazon or Thrive Market, where everything is organic. They have the largest selection of non-GMO. So they're kind of like a combination of Amazon and Whole Foods. So every subscription that you or I would purchase, then they give a subscription to a family in need. So I'd love to be on something like that. Thrive Market, yeah.
Okay. Tell me what you make of all this. Are you glad that you stopped being a banker and being a cricket farmer? And what, in the end of the day, what do you think this means to you?
Yeah, you know, like I said, what I was missing is I wasn't building anything and I wasn't helping anyone. And I think I've done a complete 180 on that. I'm definitely building something from ground up. And, you know, if I can just educate someone on the benefits of crickets, it could be a baby step in changing their life and getting them more active and getting them more conscious of where their food comes from. You know, I'm do not regret handing in that letter of resignation about a year ago. I'm just grateful that I chose the harder path, if you will. You know, many people, if you would have looked at what I walked away from, they would say, you're nuts. You should have just done that for like another 5 years and been set for life. And then you could go do whatever you want to do. Sure. But what would the cost of that 5 years have been? You know, me emotionally, me physically, everything. What would have been the implications of that? Why would
so
I start
happy.
Now? I'm incredibly happy. It is the road less taken, and it's much less security, and it's much less certainty, but I've never done things the easy way, so.
Okay, thank you so
yeah,
much.
Thank you.
That was our station manager, Ursula Rudenberg, interviewing Shelby Smith. Shelby can be found at the Ames Farmers Market with her new startup business, Jim and Eat Crickets. Yes, that's a play on words. Jim and Eat Crickets.
I just love it. Like, mm-hmm. Why would you not name your cricket shop that?
I can't imagine why you wouldn't do that. All right. I'll look for it tomorrow at the farmer's market.
Well, starting to switch gears here, let's talk about fall football. The Iowa State football team invited many members of the media the first one was to see them practice and get some footage of them practicing for the first time. And the second time was a media extravaganza, more or less, where it started off with a press conference with Coach Campbell. And then later on, media members were invited to go down on the field in Jack Trice and interview some of the team members and take pictures of them and all this fun stuff. It was actually really cool to see. I've never seen something like that before.
That's always a big deal.
Yeah, it was. It was so funny to see, like, these poor football players, like, surrounded by, like, people with recorders and stuff.
Like you.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't talk to the football players. I just kind of took pictures. But I did get a recording of Coach Campbell when he was doing a little Q&A with the media. So I got a little clip from that. So why don't we listen to
it? Let's do it.
What's the number one, like, stat that Matt Campbell goes to? Turnover guy, rushing guy, where you
Number one was turnovers. You know, we started every fall camp meeting. We start our number one meeting to start every season is that number. You know, we've got 8 criteria that we study of what over the test of time, whether it's the NFL or in college football, what are those criteria that are drive your percentage up to win football games. You know, those hidden criteria that are really successful. And the number one stat in all of football at any level is obviously the turnover margin. And certainly we were able to take another very positive gain in that opportunity last year, not just the fumble statistic, but just our turnover margin in general. You know, went from, I think, 60, 70 first year here to, you know, pushing it finally to being in the top 20. And we could have been even better at times, you know. And, you know, a fascinating stat, we're 10-2 in the last 2 years when we're plus one or better in the turnover margin. You know, I think it tells you what I've said is our margin for error, the people we play, the consistency of the people we play is still minimal, and we have to understand that, and it all starts with that. So that was number one, and then, you know, we certainly get into a lot of other statistics that, you know, we're still trying to get ourselves to, but that's a fascinating stat to me. That was the most telling stat in all of our analytics over the last 2 years that has stood up in those 8 criteria. That would have the greatest correlation to winning and losing football games for this program.
Do you guys do much with, like, advanced stats?
We do. You know, and I think it's for me, it's just where is the gap? Where is the margin? Where are we still missing the boat? How do we continue to push this forward, and how do we know where to attack? Where do we put our focus into? And, you know, if it's important, then you got to make it important. And then how is that reflected in the program by what you do, how you practice, all those things. So we use that, and, you know, and then we'll use it even weekly, you know, as we prepare for our opponents. Is it what drives everything? No. You know, I still think football's a field game in the moment. But I think there's some great statistics out there that can help you guide and navigate your football team.
Speaking with J.D. Wager told us after that game that you just told the team that you couldn't wait to get back to the offseason. What do you remember, I guess, about, touched on it last week, but the moment of after that game and already kind of thinking ahead for this season?
Yeah, I think, you know, after our last regular season last year, I was in conflict in two ways. Part of it was I wanted to do everything in my power to push that senior class and give them the right to go win this football game. And that's what we did. But I think the other conflict of me was knowing how do we grow? What's the next step for this program? And win or lose in Memphis, we got to get on that plane. We got to come back. And this program's got to, everything's got to be focused on taking the next step. And, you know, I think as I watched our team practice in those bowl games, I started to get excited about some of those guys that hadn't played, some of those redshirt guys, excited about, you know, where I thought the future could go. But also, you know, at that time we had no idea about Kyle. You know, there was a little bit of uneasiness with our football team, with where we were. But knowing that we were still a really young football team, and I couldn't wait to come back, get in the weight room, get a plan for the offseason that best fit this team. And that's what's great about our sport. Like, every offseason can't be the same. You know, every offseason's got to be detailed. And because that's what's one of the things about college football. College football is every year your team is completely different. The dynamic changes. And you have to be ready as a coach to adapt to that dynamic and make sure those margins are filled in. And so I was really excited for the challenge about this team. And, you know, I think you've heard me say this a number of times, the number one challenge was squashing any ego to think we did something or we accomplished something. There was still a lot left on the table, and there was a lot of areas that needed to get fixed and needed to grow. And, you know, the compliment goes to, I think, that sense of urgency to our players felt, that sense of urgency from the time we got in the locker room there and got on the bus and the plane to come home to really when they came back a week later from their break that they got. They've attacked it that way, and I appreciate that, and so has our coaching staff.
Last season, you praised your defense's ability to be multiple, and that was mostly with the three-man front. Now it appears you have the depth to have a four-man front. How much more multiple can your defense be this season?
Well, I think the reality is, you know, it's got a lot of pieces, and hopefully even with these young guys that are coming in, we can continue to add to the multiplicity of what we need to be. I mean, you know, it's funny, I've sat and studied NFL football. At that level, you talk about playing football at a really hard level. That game is harder to play defensive football because of the rules and some of the things that happen. Well, I think one of the neat things about our level of football is you have the ability to create this multiplicity to what you do because the rules allow you. I think that the thing that we have gotten is we've gotten faster. I think we have got the ability to continue to add some dynamic pieces to the puzzle. Still about critical situations in defensive football. And I think the neat thing for us is we're going to have the ability to show a lot of different things and, you know, help put ourselves in the best situation to eliminate matchup concerns that maybe would exist in the game, but also give us the ability to create matchups for success from a defensive standpoint, which is maybe the first time that we've been able to do that defensively since we've been here. And that part I'm excited about.
Matt, during the Monday open session when we were in there for an hour, 2 hours, whatever it was, you and Jaquan, during stretching, you and Jaquan were trash-talking.
Yes.
Back and forth.
Right, daily, yeah.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And Kyle Kemp appears to be a guy who's spoken to.
Yeah.
Which player do you like? Which attitude do you like the best?
And you know what, I love it all. And I think that's what's really fun about my job is how does each player tick? Not every kid learns, is coached, or, you know, can handle coaching the same way. And so I think, you know, that's one of the things that I love. That's why it really, what we do is what every high school teacher in America is trying to do is engage and understand how their student learns and then providing them the tools and the resources to be the best learner that they can be in the classroom. And so, you know, again, for me, everybody's different. There, you're talking right, perfect, two ends of the spectrum of how they learn, how they approach day-to-day life, how they approach it but you cut them open, they're the same kid, and they've got a world of potential. And so it's really one of the favorite things that I love about my job is every young man is different. How I have to learn how and what makes them different, and then how do I challenge them to be the best version of themselves they can be. And that's relationships and creating those relationships, whether it's through recruiting or once they get here. It's my favorite part of what I get to do.
We obviously know that Brian TV and DeAndre Payne will lead plays, these are good players on the field. But with the rest of that room being relatively young, going into this year, how important is that legacy they can leave as leaders once they've been their career?
Well, I think one of the things that's going to be really fun for those two is, you know, and I've already seen this, is their legacy of great players is really good, but there's some great talent in that room right now, and their legacy to come back someday and say, hey, you know what, how those guys work, how those guys play, what their attention to detail is, I was part of that for those guys. I help those guys get it started. And again, I think that's where we're talking in this program. You know, that's when you got a football program rather than a football team where, you know, get the older guys are teaching the younger guys how to do it, and they come back and they see the silver down the line. They say, man, I take great ownership of what those guys are doing. And then those guys, when it's their time to be that, they have the ability to pick up the next group of young guys in the program. And, you know, both Brian and DeAndre, that's one thing I love about both of those guys. Those guys have given way more of themselves than they've ever taken from the program. And I think it's got a chance to be reflected this year because I think that group is going to be critical. Those young guys now are a little bit older and have a chance to really help us and create some of those defensive matchups for us in a positive way.
Well, it was an interesting video you mentioned, the NFL. What's kind of your offseason like in terms of how much NFL footage and stuff do you study, and what is kind of your adapting based on players? Because some folks might say we're around this scheme and players have to adapt to it.
Yeah, you know, I think if anybody's ever watched us, we're always evolving. You know, one of the challenges, as soon as we get back, I'll take the top four or five teams offensively that I think in collegiate football and who like-mindedness, like conceptually, maybe fit what this year's group has got coming back. And each coach will get one of those teams, break them down, study them. We'll do the same thing in the NFL. And what we'll do is we'll kind of pull that, and then when we get off the start spring practice, you know, we'll then take that information and almost click ourselves. And we've done that since, for the last 10 years, we've done that. And to me, whether we end up using that information, whether we don't use that information, because our sport's constantly evolving. You know, if somebody else has done the play or done the concept, you know, nobody's the natural creator of that. And so one of the things that I think is really big is, you know, we're always then adapting. And you've heard me say it's players, formations, plays. Who are your players? What formations you're getting? What plays you run? But I think it's great for our coaches to learn the game and continue to pull it in. It's great for all of us to come back and say, here's what's going on. Does it apply to us? You know, maybe it's a third down play. Maybe it's red zone offense or red zone defense. You know, we do the same thing on special teams on the defensive side. And I think all those things have always helped us because you just never know, you know, really, even until midway through ball camp, exactly who those players are, and now how do you adjust the scheme to benefit them? And you better have a pretty good pool to help yourself out and do that.
Coach, obviously, there's moments off the court or off the field where you get to kind of bond as a team, and y'all got to go and have a really big team bonding thing whenever you went down and helped out with the Marshalltown tornado. What was that like going through that as a team, helping out there? You know, some perspective for the guys, you know, what was that whole thing?
You know, I think, again, that moment, we had a team activity that Saturday morning and that we were going to do. And, you know, it was actually a couple of our seniors, Julian Good-Jones, a junior, and a couple of other in our group that said, you know, it had already come across my mind, hey, should we cancel this? Should we go do this? And, you know, talking to some of our leadership team, some of those guys, and it was just like, this is a no-brainer. And you never know, because these freshmen had just gotten here. You know, there's a lot of, that's when I knew, no matter what happens this season, we've got a really good group of kids. And this, that doesn't give you anything, doesn't give you wins or losses or anything like that, but what it does give you is it gives you a chance. And I watch those kids work, and I watch those kids get back and interact. And what was powerful is not only watching our kids do that, but was watching this town who's devastated in some way, shape, or form, and the entire community is out there helping each other and working with each other hand in hand. And I think the perspective, our job as coaches, yes, football's important, this is still collegiate athletics, is to continue to foster a culture where our kids have the opportunity to grow, not just as football players, but as young men. And so I thought it was a really powerful day for us. I thought it was really powerful just to watch our kids interact with not only with each other, but with this community. And so, you know, again, that wasn't for anything other than watching that. I thought those were some powerful moments for this football team.
Coach, you've had some success recruiting in Eastern Iowa, Cedar Rapids in particular. Does it help when you get one kid that it kind of spreads the other?
You know, I think just in no matter where it is, you know, I think any time that there's a young man that comes into the program, starts to have some success, and then you start to recruit somebody else from that area, you know, again, the coaching aspect is overrated sometimes, as we think, man, this recruiting, and I recruit a young man, it's about me. One of the things I always tell young people is don't ask us as coaches. Our job is to tell you all the great things about our school. Like, right, every coach is telling you, no coach ever says, hey, don't come here. Our job is to tell you all the great things. But when you have a player, like, having a great experience, and he's got the ability to communicate that and say, you know, those coaches, this is what they really are. You know, 18 to 22-year-old kids, they're not lying. So the nice thing is they're going to tell you what's going on. And when they can communicate that to their friends or to, you know, maybe somebody in their community, I think that's really important. And so no matter where we've done and had the ability to get young people geographically, I do think that's helped us in some of our recruiting, not just the coaching aspect, but our players being able to say, hey, this is what's going on in our football program.
Coach, what do you like about Greg Eisworth? What role can he play for you in defense?
You know, Greg's background is was a high school quarterback, and I have said this a lot. I really like guys that were the high school quarterback. No matter what position they end up playing collegiately, there's something about when your high school coach trusts you to have the ball in your hand in every play, that there's just something leadership-wise about you that gives you a chance to, I think, really project. And that's one thing that Greg has given us. You know, he had the experience, probably, you know, what he would perceive probably as not the most positive experience at a Division I institution that certainly has had some success. He goes through that, you know, he transfers to get himself, so he's eligible for this year into a junior college, plays last year, gets to perfect his craft. And then, you know, I think one of the things that he has brought back to that quarterback piece is he's a communicator. He's a leader, and he brings kind of an anchor. The position we're asking to play is safety. You know, it used to be the linebackers were the great communicators. They were getting everybody situated and adjusted in football. Well, the game's spread out so much, it's those safeties that have to be elite communicators. And, you know, I think that's what we saw this spring from him, is taking great ownership and great communicative skills. And I think that's only just, you know, really, I think, moved forward through the summer portion of it. So I think that's the biggest thing about Greg that we're all excited about. And he's certainly really done a great job of what we've asked him so far, and look forward to watching him play.
We just heard from head coach Campbell talking about Iowa State's upcoming football season. It sounds like it should be pretty interesting this year.
You bet. They have a good team coming back from last year. Their third game of the season is against Oklahoma here at Jack Trice Stadium. I've got tickets for that one. I think they can beat Oklahoma. We'll see. All right. Joining us now in the studio, and we are happy to have him here again, Alex Pfeiffer from the Ames Historical Society. You're a regular joining us always once a month. Thanks for being here again.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think it's every third Friday of the month.
We're happy to have you here. Hey, you folks just wrapped up a very nice exhibit about Ames High, and what interested me about that one, it was a great exhibit, 26,738 names of high school graduates on that list. How in the world did you get those?
Oh, man. Well, we were able to use a lot of information from the Alumni Association, thankfully, with Bill Ripp. You know, they have that lovely alumni directory they put out every – it's kind of weird. There's one from 94, the 2000s, and the last one I think was from 2001. So we were able to get a lot of names from there, a lot of retyping. Yeah. By volunteers. But the book ended in 2011, so we still had to get another 7 years worth of names. So luckily the school district was able to provide us with those. And we were able to put this whole thing into a big, basically a big banner, I guess you'd call it or so. It was, I think it was 200 inches long because that's our computer program maxed out and that's as long as it would let us make it. We wanted another 2 feet added onto that, but we settled for 200 inches. So.
And it was a great banner. I looked at names that I knew, people who had graduated, and it was hard to find because there were so many names there. It was
there were a lot in there. You know, it's funny, the more generic your last name, I think the easier it was to find there because you could find like three lines of Smith. And then you just had to go through the first names. But if you had a last name like mine, you'd probably sometimes you'd spend like 5 or 10 minutes just trying to get in the right area trying to find it. But, man, it was fun. Yeah, I would just walk through that hallway, you know, all the time. And my eye would just catch people, you know, like Fred Hoiberg on there and other people that like Harold Green, who was a police officer. And, you know, just other people that are Ames people that have been gone for a little while, but had a big impact on the community.
It's a great exhibit. Congratulations. You've got one coming up, Cathedrals of the Plains. What's that about?
Yeah, we just had our opening reception last night. So Cathedrals of the Plains is a photo series. So this is done by a local artist, Judith Eastburn. And so she goes around and takes photographs of abandoned grain elevators in the Midwest. Most of them are Iowa, a few Kansas, a few Nebraska, I believe. And so she goes and takes black and white photography of those. So we have, I'm thinking of the number. It's about 25 or 26 or so of her photographs on display over there. And she provided some nice, she kind of grouped them into categories. So we have like, you know, the slip form silos together. And you can learn with a nice little panel where you can learn a little bit about more of their construction and when, you know, the time frame when those were popular, that kind of a thing. So that's a good, about 3/4 of the exhibit is her black and white photography. And then we have kind of a little corner, a quarter of it, that we're talking about the Froning and Depe elevator, which was the big elevator that was on the east end of Main Street, kind of south of like Dutch Oven Bakery. So the south side of the tracks there, which kind of hard to imagine. A big elevator there. Some people have been here for a long time probably remember that elevator being kind of a very distinctive thing in the skyline, you know, kind of the tall end of Main Street with the power plant and the elevator down there.
And it was burned intentionally years ago, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. So the Depes were trying to get out of the grain business. Trade territory had decreased. So in the 60s, we see a lot of highways getting built, a lot of interstates getting built around this area, and you don't think about it, but that is a lot of grain and corn that's not getting planted, hundreds and thousands of acres that we lost in this little what we call the trade territory for that elevator. And so after the interstate and new Highway 30 went through and other highway improvements, it didn't become feasible to run that elevator anymore. It wasn't making enough money. So they were planning to with its proximity to downtown, the property values are pretty good down there. And so they were going to demolish the elevator and sell off the property. And at that point, that's when they got contacted by the Iowa State Fire Training School here in town to use it as a fire training practice. Because if you're not aware, elevators are very flammable. Obviously, they're made out of a lot of wood, but there's also, you know, grain dust and stuff like that that can cause explosions and stuff like that. Yep. So they saw it as an opportunity to actually do a test burn, a scheduled burn on this building so that when, you know, the next one decides to go up in flames, they have a little bit more of an idea what it's going to do and how they can be more prepared for that. So it was a good opportunity for the fire training school since the building was going to come down already. But they've certainly taken a few buildings out of town here, that's for sure.
And we'll have more time later perhaps to talk about some of that. Got to run. What time's the History Center open? What are your days of operation?
We are open on Tuesday through Saturday, and our hours are 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. So it's same hours every day, Tuesday through Saturday.
I spend a lot of time there, folks. It's worth it. Go, come down and see the History Center. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Jackie, before we go, this is your last time on this broadcast. You have been with us for a year as an intern from the Greenlee School of Journalism at Iowa State. Talk a little bit about your experiences here.
Yeah. So I came here not really knowing what to expect. I talked with Becca, who used to work here, and Aaron, who used to work here, about the internship opportunities that KHOI offered. And Aaron was a videographer, and I was really interested in that, and I didn't know you could do that for radio. So I was like, yeah, sure, let's try it out. And then so I met with Ursula, and she set me up with doing videography, but then she also turned me on to the running the soundboard during local talk broadcasts, and it's been so much fun doing it. I mean, of course, I'm always exhausted in the mornings, but it's been so much fun, and I learned so much doing it, and I'm really glad I took this internship.
You have done more than run the soundboard. You have become a host on this broadcast. You have produced stories for us. You have been invaluable, and I know I speak for everybody at this radio station. We are going to miss you. We hope you stay around and come and visit us again, but you have been a great asset to this organization.
Well, thank you.
What do you do now? What's next for you?
What's next is school. My last year, so that should be fun, hopefully.
Oh, yeah, in the Greenlee School? Yeah, absolutely. Of journalism, why not?
Of course. And then after that, well, hopefully during that I'll get a job because I need to pay for college somehow.
We wish you the very best, Jackie Norman. Thank you so much. It's been fun working with you these weeks and months.
Thank you. It's been fun working with you guys, too.
Why don't you start the sign-off for us?
All right. So this has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We have been your hosts today. I'm Jackie Norman, and this is Dennis Hart.
I am Dennis Hart. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 5 p.m. right here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also remember that you can listen to the show online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the broadcast. KHOI streams live online right there at khoifm.org.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. However, we are ending the show today with a song called Until You Come Back to Me by Aretha Franklin, who unfortunately just passed away.
The great Aretha Franklin, unforgettable forever. Local Talk, a radio production as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, come on down, we'll train you. Come on and join the Local Talk team.
You, the listener, is what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for your listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The Farmers Market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment.